Welcome to the Script and Style Show, the web show where we talk about web development with the people that make it happen. Today's episode is brought to you by TrackJS JavaScript Error Monitoring. Know when errors hit your website with the context to find and fix bugs fast with TrackJS. Start your free trial today at TrackJS.com. Hey there, welcome to the Script and Style. Hey, welcome to Script and Style, the web show where we talk about web development and the people that make it happen. I'm Todd Gardner, and I don't know how to read from my script. And I'm also from TrackJS JavaScript Error Monitoring. And my co-host, David Walsh, creator of the popular blog DavidWalsh.name. How's it going today, David?
I was going to ask you the same thing. You're all over the place.
I am. I'm a little frazzled. Yeah,
me too, man. I know this is old hat for you, but I've got my my oldest kids going into kindergarten, so I'm a bit frazzled. We're all frazzled, but you're frazzled for a different reason. You got to jump on a plane here coming up, right?
Yeah, I gotta head out to the airport right after the show today. I'm heading to Austin, Texas for a couple of days. I'm going to go help a dev team do a little JavaScript debugging workshop down there for a couple of days and hopefully find myself some tasty barbecue while I'm there. Yes.
Well, I mean, make sure you use Firefox for that debugging.
All browsers. The bugs aren't limited to one browser, my friend. All browsers run into bugs. And all the dev tools are good at like different subsets of problems. And so we'll talk about Firefox dev tools. We'll also talk about Chrome dev tools. We'll talk about IE and Edge and Safari and, you know, all of the tools in the web developer's toolbox.
You're reaching back to IE. IE is still in play. Is that
IE 11 is still like a pretty common browser for enterprise clients. Like if you're building a site and it targets a corporation or an intranet, IE11 is still a pretty big deal.
Oh, wow.
And it generates a lot of bugs. So like you got a bug that's IE11 only and you got to spend time at IE11 to figure it out.
Right. Oh, that's, thank God my days of that are over. But anyways, in sort of getting you to the airport on time, I thought it would be fun this week if we did a little bit of QA. This is a QA between us. We've been sent a bunch of questions. I have a couple questions for you. We're going to make this fun. You ready?
I'm ready
to do this?
Okay, I'm ready for the fun.
First question. Happy 21st episode anniversary, by the way. This is like 5 months.
It is. We've been doing this a while at this point.
A lot of people probably haven't seen our origin story. So if you're new and you don't know much about us, jump back to episode 0 and check out our origin stories. But we're going to go a little bit further in depth today. So question one, Todd.
Question one.
What is your working setup? Are you Mac guy? Are you a Windows guy? What do we see when we go into the office? What are you working on?
So I'm rocking a 2016 era MacBook Pro 15-inch. It's the last one that you could really still take the screws out of the bottom and like mess with the internals of it. Yep. It does not have the touch bar fanciness. It has the old keyboard that works reliably. And I'm holding on to that for dear life to see if I can, you know, limp it through until Mac fix their keyboard issues. I run OS 10 on it for development purposes. I rock VS Code is my editor of choice right now. I spend a lot of time at that and iTerm for console sort of stuff. Let's see, what else? I have an external monitor that sits right next to it. I have the laptop up on one side, an external monitor up on the other, and I look out on my backyard here, which gives me some good natural light rocking in.
Yeah.
That's about what I got. Oh, and then I have a secondary computer over here, which is my Surface Pro.
Nice.
Which is my basically my pub computer, is because I'm so protective of my MacBook Pro that I can't get a new one of anymore, that like I don't actually like taking my computer out of my office anymore, even though it's a laptop. And so if I don't need to do hardcore development stuff, if I just need to do light stuff like tweaking things here and there, I'll bring my Surface with instead, because you know it's not as powerful, but it's small and it's light, and if it breaks, it's a little bit less of a big deal.
I bet. So you have no problem jumping in between the Mac and the Windows-based
Oh, I didn't say that. I have tons of problems, tons of problems. When I first switched to Mac in like 2011 or so, 2012, something like that, I had tons of problems. I hated OS X. I still hate Finder. I think it is just like a bad way of searching your files. But everything else about OS X, I've grown to kind of love, and it's just what I expect. And so now when I switch back to Windows 10, I'm really annoyed by it. Like, it asks me things a lot that I don't really want to answer. I feel like I'm always rebooting it. I feel like no matter how long it's been, I turn it on and there's critical updates that need to restart, and that drives me bonkers.
I can sympathize, and let me tell you why. Yesterday I was playing PUBG video game. Things were getting intense. Bullets were flying. Blood was squirting everywhere.
Windows had a critical update for you.
Yes. And right at the end, I turn the corner and I'm like pressing down on my mouse and nothing's happening. And I get shot, and it turns out there was a Windows notification that stole focus. So I sympathize with you there.
Yeah. Yeah. In a lot of ways, I still feel like Windows 7 might have been my peak Windows experience, but that's probably just, you know, the old curmudgeon in me being like, get off my lawn, stop changing things.
Windows XP was lit, dude.
Windows XP, other than that, you had to reinstall it every 6 months on principle.
I had to install it every 6 months because I had so many viruses from downloading pirated software that, that it was a fun time.
All right, so flip that question back around on you. What's your working setup? What are you rocking these days?
So we're mostly twinsies, right? I do have the Touch Bar MacBook Pro, and I very much like working on Macs better than Windows. VS Code the same. iTerm the same. Of course, I spend most of the day in Firefox debugging our debugger, which is pretty cool. But there was about a 6 month period where I was a big contributor to Mozilla's VR effort. And so Macs obviously aren't strong enough to deal with VR, especially, you know, not at the time. They weren't made for it. The graphics processors just suck. So Mozilla needed to get me a Windows PC. So I also rock a gaming computer to do VR stuff when I get time. But also, I'm now the designated Windows debugger bug fixer. So I also have to do some dev over here. I've got dual 27-inch monitors. And I put my desk right up against the window because the first 5 years of my career, I worked in a cubicle, and it was the worst experience of my life. So I said I'd never work without Windows. Now, I have a blog post coming up that shows off my office setup, and it's going to bring you through everything from the coffee maker to the beer fridge.
I should do that. I should do one of those for me, too.
Yeah, it's perfect. I've got a nice leather couch in here, a TV, can I sneak preview my desk a little bit?
Let's sneak preview it.
Let's see what I can get in here without running over my dog on my chair. So let's see. Dual monitors. Let's see. My VR headset, window. It's all good, man. And so I'll go into detail about my equipment and such in the blog post. And I'd be happy to publish your office blog post if you're so of mind to do it. But yeah. I have quite the workstation in here. I went from a small standing desk and ergonomic computer to two external monitors. The whole thing, man. It's like I feel like I could command like the Death Star with this thing. It's out of control. It's more than I need, but it's really quite cool.
You could command the Death Star. Instead, you command a group of 15-year-olds playing PUBG.
I can command both. I can do both at the same time. But yeah, that's my setup. And I get asked about it a lot. So I thought that was a really awesome question for us to opine about.
Yeah. So let's move on to the next one. Like, what is your day-to-day look like? So you're like, I foresee that you spend like 8 hours a day just like polishing your blog to like figure out like the next thing to launch, right? Like, what is a day in the life of David Walsh?
Yeah. So I try and keep regular work hours, right? So I get the kids ready for school, and either myself or my wife will take them, come back, hit the shower, and I like to start my work day as early as I can so that I have time for my family at the end of the day. So it's usually starting at 8:30, 9 o'clock, come in, read emails. If nothing is on fire, I just jump into the task that I had assigned myself the night before. That's the only way I can sleep at night, is if I know exactly what I'm going to be doing tomorrow. And a lot of it is, you know, working on the debugger at Mozilla isn't just working on the debugger at Mozilla. There's a lot that goes into it, right? The debugger has an enormous community. So a lot of it is emailing, Slack, triaging issues, looking at reviewing pull requests. So a lot of times there are days that go by where I don't get to touch any code. And that's really hard for somebody like me who's always judged himself on how much code he could output, right? But there's a lot more to being a senior developer than just, you know, coding. Whichever meetings pop up, but the best part about my working day is that I'm mostly left alone. I don't have a lot of meetings. My boss trusts me to get things done, so I'm not, you know, constantly being pinged for things. In the grand scheme of things, I have a boring day in that a lot of things are being thrown at me and I'm not being bugged by a lot of people, but that's exactly the way that I like it. And then at night, hang out with the wife when the kids go to bed, have a beer or a glass of wine, and start it all over again, man.
Nowhere in there was I frantically figure out what the next blog post I'm going to write is.
So I have the world's worst attention span, right? And that's why when people look at my blog, it's, you know, one day it's CSS, the next day it's JavaScript, the next day it's Node.js. It could be like some shell scripting thing the next day. If I see something, I need to know how it's done. And that's how I started my blog. That's how I got to MooTools. That's how I got to Mozilla. It's just that curiosity. So to answer your question, I see a lot of broken websites working on the debugger. So when I see that stuff and I realize what it was that had broken it, I'll write about it. Or I break a lot of things myself. And so when I break that stuff, I figure out how I broke it, why I broke it, how to fix it, and then write about that. So I don't know, man. I don't know where it comes from. I just see things. I need to know how they're done. And then I write. Now, the best part is, usually if I get my wife a glass of wine, I can get away with writing a blog post while we watch TV or hang out or something. I have a very patient wife, and that's where all that time comes from. So to answer your question, mostly at night. When I started my blog like 10 years ago, before I had a wife and kids, I would write all day Saturday and Sunday and publish during the week. But you know, being a husband and father, time is at a premium these days. But what about you? Like, what's your work day like?
I have a very opposite kind of way I do it. I do not have a set schedule at all, because I'm largely responding to family and other forces on me to kind of do what needs to be done when it needs to happen. So my kids usually have a little bit later schedule. I've taken my eldest to camp. She's been doing camp, YMCA camp all summer. And so I don't even take her until like 8:20 or so. And then I'm gone for 40 minutes, getting her there and back. It kind of depends on what needs to happen. Sometimes the dog needs attention. Sometimes other children need attention, or wife needs attention. My schedule will be like, I'll work when work needs to be done, right? Like I have this enormously flexible schedule, but it's funny because like there's this old adage in starting your own business is that your schedule is so flexible, you get to choose which 80 hours per week you work. And that's true in some ways. I mean, I don't have to work 80 hours anymore because we've established ourselves a little bit. But it's true that like our customers are all over the world, and the demands on me are at all different times of day, because my team members are working at different times of day. We have people working in lots of different time zones. And so when I need to work, I might need to you know, work for 2 hours at night to respond to somebody and like help a customer out or something like that. I might be feeling inspired on some piece of code that I'm excited about, and I'll spend 4 hours in the middle of the afternoon working when I wouldn't always be working at that period of time. And so it's kind of all over, which is chaotic at times. And I find it hard to like look back and like predict what I'm going to be doing. But it's also like really flexible. Like if I want to, if it's just a beautiful day outside and the wife and I want to go to lunch and sit on a patio somewhere, we can. We'll go do it. As long as the customer's not burning down, we'll just go and
hang out. Yeah.
Go and take advantage of the situation when we can.
Right. Yeah, that's really nice. I also try and take my wife out for lunch. I don't get out as much as I should. We've talked about this before. You know, like working from home has affected me in that I generally don't like leaving the house.
Yeah.
For anything.
I have a tendency to work the opposite of when most people work. Like Monday through Friday during working hours is my least favorite time to work because the weather is usually super nice during that period. Mm-hmm. And like outside is super quiet. Like I can walk around the neighborhood and it's super quiet. There's nobody else around. I can go to the store and be like the only one there. I can get right in on any restaurant I want to go to. It's super chill to like be out during those times. But then in the evenings and on weekends, I kind of like to stay at home because that's when other people are around and when things are busy. And when the internet is just really quiet, so I can focus. Like during the day, like social networks are blowing up. People are, you know, bored at their jobs and they're spewing stuff onto the internet. Whereas on the weekends and at night, that's happening a little bit less because people are at home chilling out, doing their own thing. And so I can focus on what I need to work on and not get distracted by people tweeting at me or whatever.
I don't think that I could do that. Like there comes a certain point in the day for me. Like I couldn't work until like 9 p.m. anymore. I'm too
I'll work until midnight sometimes.
I can blog until 9 o'clock, but like work, by that time my brain is just fried.
Yeah, but you see, the point is that you can't work that late after you've already worked a work day. I didn't work the work day. Like I was responding to a few emails and handle some critical stuff, but I wouldn't really dig into like the hard stuff until 4 o'clock.
Well, part of it is having two really small kids, right? By then, you know, like getting them ready for bed, getting them to eat, you know, bath time. I'm like cashed after that. It doesn't matter if I didn't do any work that day. Once I hit past that couple hour period, I'm like done. I can't do it anymore.
Well, so I want to key off of something you said when you were talking about your day. Is that you used to attribute like your own value during the day about writing code. And that's not where it comes from anymore.
Right.
Where do you think it comes from?
So anyone judging themselves by the amount of code they write, I don't want to say that's a young person's game, but that's how I was when I was a lot younger, right? But as you move along and as you try and work your way up the ladder, you know, at Mozilla, it's sort of like software engineer, senior engineer, staff engineer, senior staff engineer. The higher that you want to get on that ladder and the better overall developer that you want to be, it can't just be all code. You need to think like big picture, right? So it's not like I'm going to get these 10 issues done. It's more of a, where should we take the entire project next? What technology should we upgrade this to, or what should we move this over to, or how can we improve performance? How can we steadily add features without completely overhauling the project, right? How do we get more community members? Like all of these really important things have to be done by someone, and the higher of a level that you can take over a project, the bigger picture that you can see, the better engineer you're going to be, right? The better you're going to spend your time because you see things coming in the future and you can avoid mistakes. And so even at 35 years old, it's really hard for me to do that because in writing my blog about code probably doesn't help But like, it's just hard to get out of that mind frame a little bit that I'm only as good as my code, because that's not true. Like, have you ever felt that way?
Yeah, absolutely. Like, I went through a very similar journey. There's a blogger or a guy that I like a lot named Patrick McKenzie, who goes by Calzimaeus on some platforms and Patio 11 on others. He works at Stripe now, but for a long time he was in the startup-y kind of community. And I saw my biggest like kind of rate increases when I was contracting, when I adopted some of his advice of, I'm not a developer. I can solve business problems sometimes with code. And I think like that is the way you need to think about it, is the code is immaterial. Like, I think developers ascribe way too much value to like code. It's solving a problem for a business or an organization or a person. That's valuable.
Right.
Sometimes you can solve it way easier with an Excel spreadsheet. Sometimes you can solve it by sending 10,000 emails. Sometimes you can solve it by writing a big piece of software. But right. Knowing when to do which kind of option and what are the options on the table without immediately jumping to custom software, I think is hugely valuable. Kind of looking back at some of my contracts that I participated in and trying to like see where was the value that I delivered for that contract. Sometimes I can think of one where the amount, like I wrote a bunch of code for this client, but the big thing I did for them was at one like architecture meeting, I told them no. I said, this idea that you're trying to do is going to cost you a lot of money and a lot of time, and it's not going to be stable, and you should not pursue this. And I was able to convince them not to go down that path. And by convincing them not to do that, I saved them millions of dollars, which is way more valuable than any of the code that I actually wrote for that client.
What was your cut of that million saved?
not like I just got my rate. But, yeah, sure. But as terms of like what value did I deliver on that contract, the vast majority of it was being in that meeting at that time and being able to articulate why their idea was a bad idea.
Sure. Yeah, I think part of it, at least for me, comes back to imposter syndrome. And, you know, we had that great episode. One of the early episodes was about imposter syndrome. I feel like code is an easy way to judge yourself. And like, if you have a hard time,
it's objective. Like, you can look at it and say, here's the number of lines of code I wrote.
Or, right. Here's the number of bugs I fixed, that sort of thing. And it can be hard to judge yourself on planning ahead. But if you did it right and things go the way they should have, you know, you're saved a bunch of issues and stuff. So does that make sense? Does that struggle make sense? I think that I've heard a lot of young developers feel the same way, that, you know, that they judge themselves by their code. And there have been times where I've fixed a bug with a line of two or code, but it took me all day. But the impact to the project is huge, right? And so, you know, if you just judge yourself on one line of code, you feel like an idiot. That's all I did all day.
So let's talk about by inverting that conversation. This topic, I think, can quickly turn into its own show. If we invert it and say we judge ourselves by our code, think about organizations that judge you based on your code, that like have metrics about lines of code written, number of bugs fixed, cyclomatic complexity, lines or code coverage percentages. Think about something about the teams that like measure those and reward those. I have never heard of one that was not highly dysfunctional.
If that was the majority of what you're being judged by, I think yes. But in any sane environment, there are a number of criteria that I would, if I were a manager, judge along with the code productivity. One, are you easy to work with? Do you communicate well? Do you look at the big picture for more ideas? And I think this is another reason that judging yourself or others just by amount of code written is sort of nonsense. And hell, I love myself more when I remove code.
Yeah, but my favorite changes are always like, Todd deleted 10,000 lines and added three.
Exactly. Yeah. So It's a hard thing to shake, but part of maturing as a developer is finding a way to shake it and value yourself more than just code.
Yeah.
That's my feeling. Next question. This is going to be tough for you. This is going to be a tough question for you, being a.
I've been thinking about it though.
You've been thinking about it, small business owner. What do you think is the next step in your career?
I don't know.
The people with you aren't watching the show, right?
They probably are not. They're not watching right now, I hope.
Don't get yourself in trouble.
I'm not going to say anything I'm going to get in trouble for. I don't entirely know. What I do know is that the longer I've done this, the longer I've kind of run a business myself and not the consulting part, but the running TrekJS and kind of building a product and subscription-based income instead of time-based income. The longer I've done it, the more I feel like I've made myself unemployable. In the fact that, like, I don't know that I can tolerate the normal level of corporate bullshit that people are asked to endure. Like, as we started our conversation today before we started broadcasting, you said that it was, performance review time. And I had this flashback of like all the annual performance reviews that I had to be part of and what total bullshit they were, at least from my perspective. And I don't know that I could tolerate going into a job today and being like, wait, this guy is going to review how I did today or did this whole year, everything I did this year. The reorgs, the corporate politics, all of that sort of stuff. Just I feel like my tolerance for it is very, very low at this point. And I feel like I've learned a lot about business from this journey that we've been on with this. And it's still going. It's going to go for a while yet. I have no plans of like shutting anything down. Things are growing and working well.
And the web's not going anywhere.
And the web's not going anywhere. And JavaScript doesn't look like it's going anywhere. And JavaScript still looks like it's going to break a lot for a lot of people, which employs kind of both of us in a way.
Right. Keep screwing up, people. Yeah.
So, I mean, I'm going to keep rocking to this, but at some point, you know, I'll get bored of it or the market will change or whatever. And I think I'm going to try and start another business after this one because I've learned a lot. I like it. I think I could do the next one even better and faster. I wouldn't make the same dumb mistakes.
Right.
I'd make whole new dumb mistakes.
Right.
What about you? What comes after Firefox debugger?
I need to preface this with I love Mozilla, and they're going to have to drag me kicking and screaming out the door because I love everything about working for Mozilla. What's next? When we talk about like fighting, judging yourself just by code, I feel like it's sort of a natural progression that as you get older, no matter what industry you're in, you sort of get pushed into management at some point.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like the next natural
step. For a lot of organizations, there's really no way to get promoted as a developer other than into management.
Right. And so in as far as judging myself by code, I don't want to be a manager. I'm like fighting it, man. I'm fighting to hang on to my youthful coding love. So I feel like in some point I'll be in management, and I feel like I have a lot of experience and I'm a pretty
well, why do you feel like you'll be in management eventually? Is it if you don't like it, you don't want to do it, why do you see it as inevitable?
Honestly, I've struggled with my next thought a lot. I feel like the, for lack of a better term, kids coming out of college are probably going to catch up to me very quickly. Like part of me feels like in early career, you know this very well, our early knowledge was built up off of JavaScript bugs, right? Because the browser engines were doing their own thing and, you know, we became very good at that, but kids coming out of school, they don't need to deal with all that stuff. Sure, there are some browser differences, but everything's on a pretty decent playing field, right? So while I expended a whole bunch of my career trying to fix bugs that shouldn't have been there in the first place and aren't there anymore, I just feel like the younger people are going to catch up because they don't have to, they didn't have to spend all the time doing that sort of thing, right? Now, experience is invaluable, but I feel like at some point, the window is going to close on what they need to ramp up on to get to, for example, my level. It's really hard to explain this. Maybe it's imposter syndrome all over again, but
I think it is.
I don't know. I feel like the thing is, I feel like I'd be good at it. And I feel like I would be a good mentor to younger developers, to where at some point I think I might turn the corner and want to do it. Hmm. But right now I'm still like fighting it, man. I still want to be that hacker dude in the corner, go, you know, with all that madness. But that's, if I can stay in coding, and let's say Mozilla goes away completely, right? But I have two brains. There's the grown-up brain that says I should get into an engineering role at some sort of financial institution.
That sounds super boring.
I know, but through like that's adulthood. Like through osmosis, I learn a lot more about money, and you know, maybe I can make better decisions or better plays with money. On the fun side of things, I'd love to go somewhere that did streaming. That created like a streaming app or streaming in the browser. Sports would be a massive bonus because I'm really fascinated with media, and I think that would be like a good play for me. So one of those two things. Am I crazy? Does this sound crazy?
No, I think both of those are like subsets of the web that are poised to continue to grow well. I don't know about the management thing. Like, I think you should do what makes you happy. I think there's lots of ways you can become a mentor to other people other than becoming management.
Sure.
And there's a lot of different ways you can become management. It depends a lot on an organization. Like some organizations, management is cool. Like managers still like interact with code and managers aren't real. They're more like team coaches.
Right.
But in some organizations, like you'll be the one filling out the annual performance reviews and
I'll be the guy that you hate.
Going to the scrum of scrums and dealing with that kind of bullshit.
Right. No, I hear you. I don't know. I like you. I don't know what's to come. But Mozilla will have to drag me out. I know that. I'm gonna fight.
Mozilla is a great organization, but I'm going to tell a related anecdote that has almost nothing to do with Mozilla, but I just was thinking about it. I worked for a company right out of college, and the company was a manufacturing company. I worked in the IT department, and they had up on the wall, the main wall of their corporate headquarters, this plaque with like hundreds of names on it, and it was the Quarter Century Club. It's like, if you work for this company for 25 years, you get your name on that. And like this company just like people would go there and they would spend their entire careers working for this company. And they celebrated it as this beautiful thing of love, loyalty and stuff like that. I'm probably a very jaded individual, but I saw that as awful because these people came in and they did the same job for 25 years. They never really grew. They never saw other ways to do it. Like they never got experiences that were different from this one way, this one set of constraints that this one company happened to have. And so I kind of learned from that I never wanted to do that, that I wanted to go and have lots of different experiences with different constraints and a company that had different priorities and would focus on different things and different ways of organizing people and things. And so I think that's important. It's important to me. And even though Mozilla is cool, doesn't mean you can't come back. You can go try something else for a little while.
So don't go guns blazing on the way out.
Yeah, like don't go guns blazing. And I mean, honestly, you'd probably learn a lot if you went and worked for, you know, maybe Microsoft or Google and then came back, or went and worked for you know, Amazon or Facebook or some consulting company. I don't know, whatever.
Yeah, the imposter syndrome says that I couldn't pass an interview right now. Listen, Mozilla, I'm not going anywhere. Next question. What do you see as the most challenging part of the web ecosystem today?
I think you have to answer this one first. I answered first the last time.
What is the most challenging part of the web ecosystem? I think the ramping up. I mean, we used to be able to, you know, add jQuery to a project, and from there we would, you know, write a couple plugins, write some jQuery code, and for the most part we were done. But I think that the front end ecosystem has gotten so complex with Webpack, and now we're doing code splitting and you know, JavaScript loaders and so on and so forth. I feel like just the process between writing your code, setting up your environment, you know, getting all these tools working, to building the code and shipping it to the website, I feel like there's 3 or 4 more steps than what there used to be. And if I were a new developer, I think I'd be a little bit intimidated by that entire process. Yeah. Just to get code out the door. So I think that's my answer. It's just all the tools in the background that it used to be a flat plane, and now it's sort of a mountain just to get stuff out the door. You know what I'm saying? I think that's how I'd answer that question.
Yeah, I think that's a good answer. My thoughts are similar. It's not specific to onboarding, but more like stability of tools is, I guess, how I would talk about it. Is that web dev has been like growing in number of concepts like for a long time now. Where like every week, every couple of days, there's some new tech somewhere. I'm not just talking about JS libs, like that's kind of like a cliche, but like some new database server, some new like architecture, some new tech in CSS, some new way of doing styling, something is happening new all the time. And it's exhausting. It's like this concept of, you know, JavaScript fatigue or whatever. What I think is important, or the biggest challenge with web dev, is accepting that you don't have to know all of it. And in fact, resisting using the new thing. Like a lot of times, if something just came out within the last year and you're working on a big project that's going to like generate a lot of value, chances are you shouldn't use that new thing yet.
Right.
You need to let it bake. You need to like figure out what's going wrong with it. Like there's this cycle that after you've been in the industry for a while that you can see is that like, there's a bunch of old stodgy tools that are hard to work with. So new tool comes out that is better and faster and lighter and easier to use, except as people start using it because it's lighter and faster and easier to use, they realize all of the things that it didn't do. It didn't secure things this way. It didn't handle this sort of protection. It didn't handle versioning this way. It didn't do these 50 things. And as it matures and adds those 50 things to its capability, it starts to look just like the other old one.
Right.
And now it's another old stodgy thing. Like part of accepting it is that like there's a bunch of stodgy things that get in the way of the core thing you need to accomplish in most frameworks. And it doesn't mean you should avoid it. Like you just have to do it. Like you have to protect against, you know, cross-site request forgery. You have to protect, you have to build accessibility into your website. You have to do these things. And if the framework doesn't do it, then you have to do it. So I guess my challenge is that a lot of people like to jump to the new tech and then are surprised when it like is either thrashing, rapidly changing, or it's unstable. There's something to be said about using old tech that just works, that doesn't change, that is done, that doesn't have security bugs in it.
I see a lot of people jumping to the new thing and run into trouble, just like you said. If you go into new thing with just the right attitude, and by just the right attitude, I mean, hey, it doesn't do this, I'm going to write it. If you go into it with that attitude, it's cool to use new thing. But if you jump to it just because you're hearing its name all over the place and you want to try something new, you are going to get into trouble.
Yeah.
And so I agree completely with what you're saying. And I'm old enough now to see that coming and stick with the stuff that works.
Yeah. It's kind of like a discipline as a developer to like understand the problem that you're trying to solve in the organization you're trying to solve it, and picking the right tool. And sometimes that tool is to go and do a full pipeline, like is the trend right now. And you build a React Redux stack with Webpack and everything's bundled and code split and tree shaking and all that stuff. Sometimes a little bit of jQuery magic on a page that is rendered server side by maybe a Ruby or a PHP app. Sometimes that's the right way to solve it. And knowing the difference is like, it's not that that is never the right answer anymore. Sometimes that's still the right answer.
Right. Except for it's the wrong answer with jQuery. You're supposed to stick with MooTools and then we'll be fine. But
all right. Whatever.
It's my agenda. Let me have it. All right.
Sometimes a little bit of MooTools and a scripts tag on the page and it's all you need.
Perfect. Okay. So last question. Most important question. You're headed to the airport. Now, I don't know about you, but I get butterflies in my stomach before I fly. I'm not super comfortable with it. So, favorite two questions. One, favorite airport drink, if any. Two, what's your favorite overall drink? You've just fixed a billion bugs. Everyone's in bed. You get some time to yourself. Feet up. What are we going for?
That's a good question. All right. So here's the thought on airport drinks. All right. So when you're in the airport, you're about to fly. Flying, there's pressure changes. You don't want a bunch of like gas in your stomach, expanding, contraction, making you feel sick. I can't really drink beer at the airport. It makes me feel kind of sick. Makes me need to use the airplane restroom. not a good situation. So I tend to just stick with like just whiskey, just neat or on the rocks. Whatever they have, you know, the point of it there is just to kind of relax and chill out. Airports are generally not known for like being able to mix a good cocktail. I mean, sometimes there's an exception, but like a reliable place you can just rock in anywhere, you get a whiskey on the rocks.
Sure.
When I'm home or I'm at a bar that does know how to do it, I particularly like a rye old fashioned. Now, when I say an old-fashioned, I don't mean that abomination that you have in Wisconsin where you use brandy and fruit, because that's disgusting. What I mean is, you know, a couple of dashes of Angostura bitters, some muddled sugar, or, you know, some simple syrup if in a pinch, a big ice cube that's not going to melt off fast, and then two shots worth of rye whiskey. And that's it.
It sounds complicated. How much time does it take to put all this together?
Me? I can whip one up really fast. I have everything I need in my bar. It's good to go.
Oh, man.
Like a little simple syrup. So I have a bottle of simple syrup. I have a bottle of whiskey. I have a glass, ice cube, bitters, simple syrup, whiskey. Done.
We'll have like a cooking style show where you like mix some stuff up. That'll be fun.
A cocktail show. I like
Yes, it'll be good.
I'll bring my microphone over to the bar and we'll just like mix up some drinks.
I like this.
All right. What about you? What's your drink?
I'm a big IPA guy. So if I'm having a beer, I need to have an IPA, right? And you have your local beer, Surly, right?
One of many. Hyper local would be Liftbridge for me. I don't know if you get Liftbridge or in Madison.
No, let's not go super local, hyper local. Surly overrated is anything but overrated. It's very, very good.
It's really overrated. It's hilariously good.
It's hilariously good. It's unbelievably good.
But it's overrated.
Come on, man. So, you know, if it's a cool day, I'll grab one of those. Otherwise, when the kids are in bed and it's time to hang out with my wife, a good glass of... why can't I think of it? Sauvignon Blanc is perfect.
I am so glad that you said Surly and not like New Glarus.
See, here's the thing. As a Wisconsinite, I am very willing to say that I am not a New Glarus guy at all. For those that don't know, there's a big craft brewery about a half hour from where I am, called New Glarus in New Glarus, and their big beer is Spotted Cow, and it gets served at like every party you go to, and it's not for me.
It's somehow gotten associated with like Wisconsin state pride of like, I'll cross over the border to like go somewhere and they'll be like, oh, you can only get this in Wisconsin. Like this is like the Wisconsin craft brewery. And I'm like, well, it's only sold in Wisconsin because Minnesotans won't tolerate it.
I like my beer as bitter as I am. And that's why I like IPAs and stuff like that. The New Glarus just doesn't do it for me. I need a taste bud killing beer.
All right, so what about like the double IPAs from Surly, like Todd the Axeman and Surly Abrasive?
Those are too much because they end up being like 8, 9, 10%, and like you can't even get through one without passing out.
So have you had any of the stuff from War Pigs?
No, but based on name, I feel like I
should. All right, so a guy named Todd Haug, who was the master brewer for Surly, got quit or got forced out or something went down that isn't entirely public, where he left Surly. And so he's like this, maybe that was a year and a half, 2 years ago. And so their old stuff, like overrated, it was all him. He made those. The new stuff isn't. But he went down to Chicago and partnered with the Three Floyds Brewery.
I like that.
They made War Pigs together.
Okay, cool.
So War Pigs is Three Floyds and the zeitgeist of Surly together.
Nice.
Okay, so their stuff is real good. It's real good.
So the official beers of Script and Style, Surly overrated? And is War Pigs the name of the brewery or the beer itself?
It's not the beer itself because they have a bunch of different beers, but there's some organization or collaboration or series of beers called War Pigs.
Okay. And which whiskey is the Script and Style recommended?
Right now, my favorite whiskey is High West Double Rye.
Holy smokes.
That's my whiskey of choice right now. Although, I like whiskey a lot. So I have a lot of different whiskey.
So it's a good recommendation.
It's
from a connoisseur.
I would not drink it neat, maybe. It might be a little too harsh to drink neat, but in an old fashioned, double rye. Yes. From High West.
I'll just talk about beer. We better end this because I'm getting thirsty.
Well, we do have one. We have one more like finisher. From a fan, Ollie had asked, which one of us is the best dancer?
I am a terrible dancer.
Yeah, but I could see you like, you have a little bit of like a 90s boy band thing going on too. And so like, I could see you busting out like an NSYNC thing.
Well, thank you for attending the last episode of the Script and Style Show. No, I do. I do not have... Well, it depends. If I get one of those whiskeys, maybe I can do something. But other than that, I am not a dancer.
Nor am I. So it's a competition of who is the worst dancer instead of the best, I think.
We're going to dance around this question and get you off to the airport.
Good answer. Good answer. All right. Well, I think we'll wrap it up. Do we have takeaways? You like anything that came out today?
Takeaways. I'm going to look for War Pigs because I like that beer. The other thing is that I like shows like this where we get pinned with these questions because I see the question at first and I think it's a fairly simple answer, but it does end up causing a lot of retrospection about the type of developer that I want to be and how I can improve. So thank you to those who sent in questions. Thank you for your questions, Todd. I think I have a lot to think about. What about you?
I really like that you and I were kind of on the same page with the challenging part of web dev, and that we thought that onboarding and like getting started and understanding like the litany of tech out there is this hard, challenging part. And that it's okay to not know it. And it's okay to just do what needs to be done to get the job done.
Awesome. Sounds good, man.
Yeah. All right. I actually do not think I am available for our show next week, unfortunately. I am going to be road tripping with my family. I will be driving by and waving at you on our way to Chicago for a family road trip. So I think we'll be back on the 30th. If you're good with that, David.
I'm good.
Awesome. Well, we'll be back on the 30th with a new show. Until then, I'm Todd Gardner.
I'm David Walsh.
Adios, everyone. The Script and Style Show is recorded and produced by David Walsh and Todd Gardner. We'll see you next time on Script and Style.